helped maintain the farm. The father was a hard disciplinarian, harsh in his treatment of his children, and Mao was made to obey, though the Chinese code made it easier because every son is supposed to obey his father. And the teachers that Mao had in school were strict, so he had an upbringing that prepared him for difficulty. The father was barely literate, and the mother wholly illiterate. So he comes out of a peasant background without much home education, though he did go on to school. His mother was a devout Buddhist. Just what this might mean to Mao, we don't know. But she did have an interest in the religion of the Buddhists, and Mao grew up under her influence. She was very charitable, and there are traits in Mao's character that reflect his mother's influence. He graduated from the Hunan Normal School in 1918, so he had prepared himself for teaching. And in that, in 1917, he had helped form the New People's Study Society, which turned towards Marxism. And it's in this little group of people around the librarian at the University of Peking, with Li Tachao, the leader, that Mao became an avowed communist. And with 10 others, he formed the Chinese Communist Party in 1921. I mentioned yesterday that he married Li Tachao's daughter, who was a theoretical communist, and taught this group around him what the theories of Marxism were. Later, both Mao's wife and her father, the father-in-law of Mao, were executed by Chiang Kai-shek's party because they were communists. So he had good reason in his own personal experience to hate those who had caused this tragedy in his family. Between 1921 and 1927, as we tried to show yesterday, the communists agreed to go along with the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang, and they stood in pretty close connection with Moscow. To begin with, the Chinese Revolution was affiliated in a sense with the Russian Revolution. And had there not been a Russian Revolution, there certainly wouldn't have been the kind of a Chinese Revolution that we know. But we'll find that this alliance didn't continue. There are great differences between the Chinese and the Russians. And under Stalin, when the Russian communists were themselves terrified by this leader who were executed in the purges, anyone who was opposed to him, the Chinese communists didn't want to go along with Stalin. And we had the beginning of the breakup between them. We go on now to 1949, when the Communist Party took over the government. Recall that in 1934, Mao led this long march up into the Northwest with his party, and then the party, together with the Nationalists, opposed jointly the Japanese invasion in 1937 until after the World War made it impossible for the two to go along with each other, and there's a civil war between 1945 and 49. But by 49, the communists had gained control of the government. And we have a new period in Chinese history. They organized the Chinese People's Political Consultation Conference in Peking. And in October 1st, 1949, they formed the People's Government of the Chinese People's Republic. That is the name of China today, the People's Republic. And Mao, all the way through, has insisted that he is interested in the common people, in the peasants, and that it's the working people that are to be the rulers of the country. He did allow other parties to exist for a time if they were not opposed to the communists. There was a Federation of Trade Unions, a Federation of Women, a Federation of Youth. There was a Democratic League that, in a sense, represented some of China who were not communists and worked together with Mao. But gradually, the party became the dominant one. Mao was the chairman of the party's Central Committee and of its Military Council. And the premier of this Central People's Government was Zhou Enlai. And it's interesting that these two men still are the two great figures in China today. 1949, they were the leaders. That's 25 years ago. And 25 years is a long time for revolutionary leaders to maintain their position. There has been opposition, as we'll see, and there have been conflict, but they still maintain themselves. Zhou Enlai, spelled C-H-O-U, the Chinese C-H is like a J in this case, without the aspirate. Zhou Enlai, Mao Zedong, and at this time, the other leader was Liu Shaoqi. It's not easy to remember these Chinese names. Much more difficult to spell them sometimes. L-I-U-S-H-A-O hyphen C-H-I. These three men were really the leaders of the party. In 1954, they set up a People's Congress and adopted a constitution which took the place of the previous consultation conference. There were 1,226 delegates that came from all over the country. And they formed this Congress and gave authority to a standing committee when they were not in session. And Liu Shaoqi was the chairman till 1959. The standing committee had 35 members. Then there was a state council where Zhou Enlai was chairman. There was a military council. And the chairman of the republic was Liu Shaoqi. The chairman of the Central Committee was Mao Zedong. What you're getting here is a little coterie of men who assume complete control of the country. And while theoretically communism is a people's government and supposed to be the democratic way in which you organize the nation, actually, Chinese communism has been autocratic from the start. And whatever judgment we pass on it, whatever merits or demerits it has, we do recognize that there is an authoritarianism. It's not a democracy, even if it calls itself such. And from the beginning, the Communist Party has been dominated by a small group which knows what they want. They have a very definite program, and they're able to get the country along with them. They do have one ally that is indicated when I refer to the Defense Council or the Military Council. They're in control of the army. And I think one secret of the success of the communists in China is that Mao and Zhou Enlai at all times have had the complete control of the military. The previous history of China, especially after the end of the Manchu dynasty, was a breakup of the country into a great many different groups or regions. And you had a warlord here and a warlord there. There were half a dozen of them in the north and south and east and west, and each one had their own army, some of them up to 40,000, 50,000 men. And they tried to have authority in their particular province, and sometimes they tried to work with each other to have a larger sphere of influence. But after the defeat of Chiang Kai-shek, by the way the communists operated, they got control of the armed forces so that there could be no rebellion against them. And we'll find that this 25-year period is rather free of military opposition against the government. There was no one that had the power to rebel. The trouble was within the party itself, but not between the party and the people. To begin with, there was this political and military alliance with Russia from about 1950. The main argument of the communists was that they were going to restructure the economy of China. They took control of all state property, and everything was under the central government. They got a huge amount of U.S. material that had been sent over to Chiang Kai-shek. They took the Japanese possessions in China, which had been growing ever since 1931 when the Japanese invaded China. And they took over all of the middle-class capitalism. And this, of course, is one of the theories of communism, that the state should own all of the means of production. In a capitalist society, you have private property. A man can own private property as much as he can gather, and the state will secure his title to it. But the distinction between capitalism and communism, one of the distinctions is that there can be no private property is over against the state. The state owns everything. The state owns all the land, all the mineral rights, and decides how it's going to be used. In 1950, at the very beginning of the communist reign, there was a confiscation of all the property, of all the land, and a redistribution of it. All the property of the missionaries, for instance, the church properties, were lost to the missions. The government simply closed the churches and the schools and took possession of them. They took over the schools the missionaries had founded, both the secondary and middle and the universities, and requisitioned the property. So that what the West had invested in China passed over into the communist ownership. Then they set up in each community a cadre, C-A-D-R-E, cadre, or a sort of a little group of people who were called the People's or Peasants' Tribunal. They were peasants, they were people who lived in this community, and they were going to try the enemies of the state. In the community where you lived, you would have a group that set themselves up as judge over those who'd been landholders, who had been unjust to the peasants, who owned too much property, and who had been against the revolution. And this is one of the dark pages of communism, because there isn't much justice in this. Anybody could take out a grudge on someone else in the community, and especially if you owned any property, you were subject to their tribunal. Not only would your property be taken away from you, you might be put in prison, or even worse, be executed. It has been estimated that probably 1 million people lost their lives in this process. It's a revolution. Mao says somewhere that a revolution is not a picnic, and it certainly wasn't in China. A revolution involves bloodshed, and that's true in any revolution. One of the bloodiest was the French Revolution, The American Revolution was bloody enough. And certainly the Russian Revolution, when the Bolsheviki took power, and later under Stalin, became a massacre. So we have reason to fear when the revolution becomes the means of changing. When you study these various countries in which revolutions have occurred, I think you have to come to the conclusion that had the people in those countries foreseen the forces that would cause a revolution, they would have come to some kind of compromise before it was too late. But that isn't the way things happen. It seems usually in history that those who own things, those who have property, those who have authority, will not give it up until it's taken away from them by force. And in a democracy such as ours, we try through our legislation to avoid the kind of situations which lead to armed conflict. But the conservatives in any society are usually blind to the strength of the revolutionary movement, and until it's too late. And certainly that was true in China. Until the time that the communists took over, those that had property, those that had wealth, those that had authority in China were trying to hold on to it against an overwhelming force. Remember that 9 out of every 10 Chinese was a peasant. And he didn't own his own land or very little. He worked hard, he had little to look forward to. And when Mao comes with a program that promises him a living, piece of land, constant employment, better conditions, can you blame him that he joins the party and at least is in favor of the change? In this redistribution of property, each farm family was left about 2.5 acres, which isn't a lot of land, but to one who had no land at all, it certainly seemed a great thing. So at the very start of the Chinese Revolution, you have a redistribution of land among the peasants so that someone feels that he has something that's his own and can begin to work it. The missionaries, of course, were expelled. The feeling of the communists was that the missionaries were a part of the, if not the dynasty under the Manchu, certainly of the nationalists under the Kuomintang or Chiang Kai-shek. And when they got rid of Chiang Kai-shek, off went everything connected with him. So that the alliance between the Chiang Kai-shek and the missionaries was the reason for the downfall of the missions. They were simply swept out with the nationalists themselves. Even foreign journalists were not allowed in China. And for the next 25 years, there are practically no American journalists in China. There are some other journalists who got in from other countries. One of the few exceptions in America was Edgar Snow. Edgar Snow had gotten to be a friend of the communist leaders, and had many conversations with Zhou Enlai and with Mao, and from the beginning understood what was going on. His first book was Red Star Over Russia, over China, which gives us a very complete picture of the China at the time of the revolution. And his second book, about 10 years later, On the Other Side of the River, the title of it, is one of the best accounts that we have of what actually happened in the development of China until the end of the 60s in our own time. So that when you read much of the literature on Russia in this period, almost every writer depends on Snow's material. The books are large, they're full of detail, and writers help themselves to the things that Snow had found out. He gives us a lot of information about the farms, the mines, the great public works that were being done, as well as the political side of it. If you want a long, detailed account, you read these two books of Edgar Snow, you have gotten what most people have not read until our own time. There are other journalists who give us accounts of what happened. I happen to have a good friend in Sweden who was acquainted with the editors of some of the large Swedish newspapers who sent reporters to China. And for a while I had a constant stream of reports coming from the Swedish newspapers, which carried these articles which had come out of China through the Swedish reporters. Likewise, Japan had reported in China, and they published some of their findings. Canada was on better terms with China than we were, and there were a few Canadians. There was a Canadian doctor who had become a very close associate of the communists, and he stayed on after the revolution and worked as a doctor among them. So there are a few exceptions, but on the whole, we simply blacked out China from our consciousness for 25 years and knew little or nothing about China. Didn't care, didn't want to. We didn't think it made any difference. Fooled ourselves into believing that this little group around Chiang Kai-shek in Taiwan represented China and the United Nations. Shows how foolish we have been, but it's too late now to amend that. The missionaries, of course, went to different regions. Many of them went to Formosa, and it started Christian missions and schools there. You'll find quite a few of them in Hong Kong. Many went back to England or to the European countries from which they came, or back to this country. By 1952, you could say that the Chinese communists had gained control of practically every phase of Chinese society. And quoting one very fine writer, this sentence is a sort of a summary. By 1952, Peking had stabilized the currency, restored the wrecked communication system, brought industry and agriculture nearly back to the pre-war level, extended and consolidated its machinery of domestic police control over the entire country, and eliminated the three domestic enemies who had existed in 1949. That is, the capitalists and the foreigners, anti-revolutionaries. It had redistributed the country's agricultural land. For a group in 3 years to do that in the country, the vast size of China, whatever your attitude may be towards the communism, you have to admit that they had some kind of ability and skill and success. They had their problems, certainly. China lacked capital and leaders in heavy industry. They had tried to keep out all the Western inventions until they found that they had to imitate the West in order to compete with them. They had expelled foreign capital. They'd taken over the investments of other nations in China so that there was little or no trade. And they had practically no technology. In 1952, they announced the first five-year plan. And you'll find for the next couple of decades, one five-year plan after the other. It's not very easy to say what these plans included because they didn't always announce what it was going to include. And sometimes the plans extended over 5 years. They're not consecutive in that sense. They did get help from Moscow, and a lot of Chinese students went to Russia. In the first decade, 6,500 Chinese students went to Moscow to study. I was in Moscow 10 years ago at the great university, the People's University in Moscow, where students come from all over the communist world. And it's a sight that is unlike anything I've seen elsewhere, where you have students of different colors, different backgrounds, coming together in Moscow, the center of communism, to learn the theory and the practice, and then going home to their countries. It's one way in which Russia maintained a sort of a autocratic control of communism in all countries. This bringing of the students from China, the thousands of them, at Chinese expense, meant that they could come back and apply in China the things they'd learned in Russia. We can't, I think, overestimate the influence of young people going to other countries. American students now, of course, go to Europe as if it were a weekend vacation. And unless you've been in Europe for a term or a semester, your education in college here doesn't seem to be complete. We are learning much from Europe. I'm not quite sure that these students always learn only academic things when they go. Some seem to have a good time or anything else, but they do see another part of the world. And I think even in our church schools, we would do well if we made it possible for our students to go abroad to learn other countries. And wouldn't hurt if we had scholarships to China, to Japan, and to the other Oriental countries to get to know these people as they actually are. The emphasis in this first five-year plan was on heavy industry. They were going to build machinery. They were going to have the kind of tanks and heavy machinery that the West had to tackle the great problems of immigration or agriculture. And they had plenty of coal, they had oil, they had chemical works, but they didn't have the personnel. And with a population of over 600 million, it's awful hard to say what the population of China is. You get different figures from different people at different periods. But about 1950, it's estimated there were about 600 million Chinese, which has now grown to closer to 12 million. The plan did allow for some money to go into agriculture and forestry and water conservation. People got excited and they were going to set up little steel or little forges and steel mills in their own backyards. And you have in this first five-year plan a lot of waste that people didn't know how to go about it. They were going to produce iron, produce steel, they were going to build things. There was some increase in steel and coal production. But the fault of the plan was that it didn't pay enough attention to agriculture. And here is, after all, where the strength of the party lay. In July of 1955, there were 17 million households in cooperatives. Mao wanted half of 110 million peasant families in cooperatives or collectives by 1957, and the other half by 1961. He thought within 5 or 6 years they could reorganize all of China into cooperatives or collectives. And these are the stages by which you intended to revolutionize agriculture. A collective was where you pooled land in joint ownership. We have collectives and cooperatives, of course, in our own country. But in China, it was a larger region where all the land was held in common, and then the individuals could work out their best results. But the higher stage was a commune, where the whole program would be worked out by the top administration, and the whole country would be organized on the same principle of a commune here, of course, is where the word communism comes from, where a county would be considered as a unit. And they would have a certain amount of work to do. They were supposed to produce a certain amount of goods, either in farm products or industrial goods. And the state would take all of this, buy it from them, and then give them their wages and their housing and their food and their schools. It didn't work out. They were not ready for this kind of thing. And there was a good deal of grumbling among the peasants. They even had to have food rationing by the end of 1955. But the pattern was there so that we know in what way they were going. Meanwhile, China was having trouble with its foreign neighbors, especially the United States. The United States, you remember, entered Korea about this time, Korean War, 1950. And the Chinese, whether we thought so or not, were afraid that we were using Korea simply as a stepping stone to come into China. And that is why the United States finally understood that if we crossed the 38th parallel, there would be war with China. MacArthur wanted to, Truman said no. In this case, Truman certainly saw better than MacArthur did. It would have involved us immediately in war with China, which considered Korea, certainly North Korea, as simply an open door into China. We supported Chiang Kai-shek with our Fifth Fleet, that you remember patrol the straits between Taiwan and the mainland, and sometimes there was heavy fighting. It was the time when we formed CETO, that southeastern organization of states by which we ring China, and we hope to get all of these countries around southern China into an alliance. And China looked upon us as beginning to try to force it through these military alliances to its policy. The cooperation with Russia didn't turn out to be what they had hoped. China asked for much more help from Russia than Russia was willing to give. Russia did give a lot of help, and it sent a great many technicians into China to help them build steel factories and show them how to mine, and especially in industry, to educate them. It lent them, loaned them money. But you begin to find that China wants to think of itself as its own leader in communism. Meanwhile, there was a question of how to go about getting the whole people to follow the program. After all, the membership of the Communist Party was rather small. And that's true both in Russia and China, that not much more than 2 or 3% or 5% of people belong to the party. It's the party that rules. And you can't get into the membership of the party unless you are a dedicated communist. They have a strict discipline, but as a member of the party, you are a part of the government of the state. There's no popular government outside of the party. The party rules. Mao thought that it would help things if he gave the people a chance to criticize what they didn't like. And especially since the five-year plan wasn't working out well, allow them to express their dissatisfaction. And so you have that peculiar period when Mao said, let 100 flowers bloom and 100 schools of thought contend. It's a reference to a time when there were 100 philosophers in old China. And Mao said, let 100 flowers bloom now. Let each one say what he likes. Then let the voice of the people be heard. Well, they got too much criticism. And it wasn't long before they shut down on this opening of the dam. They discovered that there were too many weeds among the 100 blooms and flowers. And especially the intellectuals, the people in the universities, which had opposed, many of them, the communist revolution from a theoretical point of view. The result was that after they had expressed themselves, the ruling party knew where their enemies were. There are those who think the whole thing was contrived, so that it gave a chance of opening up discussion and finding out who the critics were. Well, it worked that way, and the critics consequently found themselves in prison or out of power because now the government knew who they were. So any free discussion in China is practically out from this time on. We will find a very interesting phenomenon in another decade, but it was not a very successful way of winning the people to the program. Nor did the help from Russia come. And the result was that when Stalin began to control Russia through the purges and through his autocratic rule, there is a break with the Chinese. And the Chinese finally told the Russians, we don't want your help. In fact, we're better Marxists than you are. They call the Russians revisionists and claim that the Russians were making too many compromises with the capitalist world, and they were themselves becoming a sort of a capitalist country. So China considered itself a purer communist country than Russia. Well, Russia packed up its technicians and even some of its heavy machinery and went home and left China without the help that they had wanted from Russia. Back of all this, of course, you had the constant irritation of the boundaries on the north. The Chinese have never trusted the Russians, and every time the Russians wanted more concessions in Manchuria, in the Trans-Siberian Railroad, or across to the Pacific, they have seen a threat to themselves. And there are large forces stationed on the Amur River up in the north, where Russia and China face each other. So that today, as for the last decade, China and Russia have not been on very good terms. China went on its own. It did what it called walking on two legs, which was to combine the old and the new methods. And they went ahead with their organization of communes. You would have a village where the people lived in a dormitory. And the family would, both man and wife would have work. Their pay would be regulated by the government. There was no unemployment under this system. And the top Soviet simply means a council. You can have a Soviet on a local level, you can have a provincial Soviet, and you can have the top Soviet. The top Soviet, Mao and Zhou Enlai and Liu Chao, directed the program, and it went down through their subordinates to the very lowest level. So the whole country was organized this way, and everybody had a part in the program. By 1958, there were 600,000 backyard furnaces, where little groups of people were trying to build up the steel. There were irrigation projects and factories. The peasants and laborers worked for 14 or more hours. The commune gave them nurseries and schools, wages, the land, the animals, the tools, the equipment was all owned by the state. The program, while it didn't succeed, did give the peasants something that they'd never had before. They did complain of long working hours and the loss of private homes and family meals, and that there was no increase in the rewards when they did well. There was a careless use of tools. So that by 1958, the Central Committee made changes. It allowed the people to have some private property. They could have a small private house of their own. They could have certain tools they could call their personal property. They could have a little vegetable patch of their own. And the wages were made to conform somewhat to what the man produced. And the members could choose to eat at home rather than in the common dining hall. In slack season, they were not supposed to work over 8 hours. In busy, not over 12. They would have 8 hours of sleep, 4 hours for meals and recreation. You see, it's a system where everything is outlined for you. Everything is programmed. And everybody has a place in this system. And while there's a lack of freedom, remember, these people never had any freedom anyhow. We judge everybody by what we call American freedom and forget that there's no country in the world that's had the freedom we have. And when you give a serf a little bit, he's thankful for that little bit, even if there isn't much freedom associated with it. It's part of our lack of judgment of other people that we judge everybody by ourselves. And to expect that the Chinese communists should give freedom to everybody to do what they would want would simply wreck the system that they had set up. Well, there isn't any question of freedom, and the Chinese haven't much complained about the freedom except the intellectuals. And common people, the majority, were thankful for what the party had done for them. The commune became a means of life for them, and the employment of everybody, men and women for the first time were given an equal status with men, equal wages in many cases, so that comparing what they had with what they had had before, they felt that the communist government was doing them a great favor. In the commune, you would have a production brigade. If it was a county, you would have several production brigades. And everybody in the region would be a member of the commune brigade. The brigade would be set certain quotas that it was to produce. If they produced more, it was to their advantage. If they produced less, the government would investigate why. But the tools and the control of the land, it was all, of course, under the state ownership. The wages in 1959 were about 30 to 40% in supplies and 60 to 70% in money. They didn't get their wages all in money, but they got their nurseries where the parents could leave the children while they worked. They got kindergarten and elementary schools, not much beyond that. They got free hospital care, free medical care, so they were certainly in a much better position than they'd ever been before. Our time is running out on us. I'll have to close with a reference to a movement that we still aren't quite clear what it meant, and that's the Cultural Revolution between 1962 and 1964, a period that is the most confused in our understanding of China. For it looks as if Mao and his fellow leaders were beginning to be distrustful of the organization that they had set up. And so they instigated a sort of a revolt against the party organization in the various communities by the Red Guards. The Red Guards were mostly young school children or university youth who began to accuse the bureaucracy, the ones who head office, of wanting to become autocratic and an elite again. You can't avoid this. Those who had the power thought that they were a little better than those they were exercising the power over. And the peasants, Mao got them to believe that you'll have to clear out these people who think they're so important in order to keep the revolution going. The cultural revolution it's called, because they were to rid the country of anything that smacked of the old capitalistic culture, where the officials in government set themselves up as being of some importance, or where those who went to school thought that they were more important than the manual laborers. And this is a very interesting phase, because the communists right along had believed that you should not have an educated class that's apart from the manual labor. And so a part of the system was that you went to school, and even the professors in the universities would be in school for a few months, and then they'd go out on the farm and work with the farmers for 3-4 months, especially during harvest time, so that you wouldn't get one class against the other. And the academic class was to be manual labor as much as the manual labor was to be educated. And the Cultural Revolution was directed against the academic part, the intelligentsia, the power-holding part of the government, and it looks as if there were a breakup in the party itself. And most of the blame for what had gone wrong was directed against Liu Zhao, who was one of the three top leaders, and he was in disgrace. It may be that Mao's own hold on the party was threatened, and that this was the way in which he was trying to regain it. Well, he did, because for one while the universities were closed down altogether, and there were no higher schools. And it's only within the last couple of years they've been opened up again, and now they're open only to a certain element of the population. The majority must come from the farming class. This Cultural Revolution, very few writers seem to be able to make out what happened exactly, and we probably won't know until we have more understanding of China.
I wanted to mention one parallel that's always sort of amused me. In the young people of American universities, they could take over Columbia and Harvard and other things for a while with great ease. They took over the Chinese universities and they were not in operation for a year or so. When they assaulted the Chinese factories, there was a rough equivalent of Chinese hard hat who fought back.
Yes.
There were a few deaths there. So in most instances, the large factories were not taken over, but the universities were disbanded with great ease. And there is a slight American parallel there.
You might have wished that the parallel had gone farther, that these American university youth had gone out on the farms and helped in the farm problems.
Which makes me think of a quip during Stalin's horrible years, when a Russian university professor who was in good with Stalin went out to a concentration camp and saw one of his old colleagues whom he detested cleaning the latrines. He said, "The regime that makes one like you clean latrines cannot be all bad."
Yeah. Well, that's good. Probably some American professors would like to see the same thing with regard to their rivals. We do have an upheaval in the educational system. And the educational system of communist China is itself a topic that we should spend more time on, because it has tied education close to the life of the people. And there are those in America today that think that we too can develop an elite that hasn't too much sympathy with the working man, but sets up an academic world that's supposed to be a little superior to others. You're dealing here with rather deep, common human forces, and they work out themselves in different ways in different countries. Well, my time is up, and I feel very dissatisfied with having to end just here. But when you're dealing with a continent like China, you can't more than peck away a little bit here and there. I hope that during the week you may have gotten some sense of the dimension of the problem and begin to understand that we need to know more about half the world, a quarter of the world, in which we are living, and that we don't make such easy judgments as we sometimes do about a whole country and about a whole people. There's hardly a day goes by but you find a reference in the newspapers to China and what's happening. Of course, nothing was quite as dramatic as Nixon going to China and changing in that respect our attitude towards China after he'd spent most of his life speaking against all the forms of communism. But now we have a minister or an ambassador practically in China, Bruce, and we'll probably get a new view of China. I haven't had time to speak about the prospects of the church in China. Next week, for a few of you that will probably be here then, I'm going to take selected subjects from these periods that I've covered this week and speak about one day probably more in detail on Confucius, on Buddha, and on Mao's, Mao's little red book, Mao's thoughts, are enough of the subject for one day itself. I'd like to read a good many selections from this book, which was the Bible, and still is to a large extent of the Chinese people. Well, as you go home, if you're interested, go to your local library and find books that will help you to fill the gaps that I've had to leave in my treatment of China. Thank you.